Welcome to Oncology Today, the emerging role of cereblon E3 ligase modulators, CELMoDs, and other novel approaches to targeting protein degradation pathways in multiple myeloma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Paul Richardson from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. And in addition to this interview, there's also a corresponding video featuring Dr. Richardson's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to provide an overview of what we know about the mechanism of action of IMiDs and the role of cereblon.
I think of cereblon E3 ligase as a vital construct and switchboard in B-cell pathobiology. And basically, the impact of in modulating cereblon E3 ligase results in downstream effects on these key transcription factors that control B-cell proliferation on the one hand. So this is directly a pathway that influences proliferation of a malignant B-cell. And at the same time, by modulating Ikaros and Aiolos degradation, these are two key proteins, you have a profound effect on the immune system. So this is a sort of double hit, if you will, that you have a direct tumor effect and you have an effect on the immune system. So the downstream effects are profoundly immunostimulatory and also tumoricidal. And so you get the impact of tumoricidal, immunogenic effects on the tumor cell combined with this immune stimulation. And that's probably interesting enough why, Neil, you have synergy with proteasome inhibitors that's so profound, because you've got the immunogenicity of the proteasome inhibitor combined with the effect of the degradation seen on Ikaros, Aiolos, and those consequences. So you've got that synergy that occurs. Because one of the questions that's come to mind is, well, if you've got the degradation of Ikaros and Aiolos, and that's actually proteasome dependent, why on earth aren't you seeing antagonism? And you're not. You're seeing synergy. So I think in a very simple way of thinking of this, I would say, think of cereblon E3 ligase as a key switchboard. It controls fundamentals of pathobiology in B-cell neoplasms. Disrupt that, modulate it, because activating it is perhaps a bit too simplistic. It's not really an activation; it's a true modulation, especially for the CELMoDs. And then that results in a series of downstream effects that have profound impact on myeloma cell biology, and importantly on the immune system.
So that was really helpful to me. Let's just take it one step further. When you talk about these two mechanisms, the direct effect on the tumor and then the effect on the immune system, how would you compare those two impacts, CELMoD versus IMiD?
Dramatically different. As you can see, the degradation kinetics for the CELMoD are remarkably greater. And I would stress, actually, for the 7455 degrader 2, the effects are dramatically more powerful. I think the important point is that the degradation kinetics are different, and this in turn leads to profound effects on proliferation and on immune stimulation. And I think what's particularly helpful is when you look at the molecules, right? If you look at the molecules, their size is radically different. Their engagement into the pocket is different. So the CELMoD goes in and really clicks in and binds to the pocket. Now, importantly, the 7455 molecule is quite different. So that's not in that same category. So CELMoDs are, in my opinion, distinct. So you've got the IMiDs with their sort of off-the-shelf by accident discovery, if you will. And then you've got CELMoDs, which are specifically designed and engineered molecules to do that much more. And I think that's a distinction that's critical to understand.
How about the immune impact, CELMoD versus IMiD?
Substantial, again, differences in terms of natural killer cells, which I think is a real asset potentially of the CELMoDs, where the natural killer cell population is activated dramatically. And we've got combination studies with elotuzumab, for example, that are looking very promising. And at the same time, you see this ability to overcome resistance to immunomodulators clinically, which suggests to me it's not just the tumoricidal effect that you're driving the resistance being overcome, you're actually doing something to the immune system where you're actually getting that much more bang for your buck from your cellular immunity. So one of the jokes we have in the group is that, mezigdomide is CAR T in a pill, and obviously we're being, facetious. But the reality is it has a remarkably potent cell effect or immune effect. And when you combine it with other immune activating agents, we clearly see that.
Really interesting. Can you go back? That's really interesting, the idea of combining it with elotuzumab. Can you review again how elotuzumab works and theoretically why there might be synergy?
Sure. Because elotuzumab is obviously SLAMF7 is the target. It's a specific activator of natural killer cells. And what's particularly attractive is that it brings the myeloma and the natural killer cells together because it activates SLAMF7, which is obviously on the natural killer cell, but it also activates that receptor on the myeloma cell. So you bring these guys together. But you need the immunomodulatory drug to make it all work. So we've got great data with lenalidomide combined with elotuzumab. We've also got even better data, in my opinion, with pomalidomide and elotuzumab. So that suggests because POM has more of a natural killer cell effect, is this natural killer cell axis important? Well, you go to a yet another degree of difference when you engage with the cell mods. So I think that this is why we believe we're seeing such potency. And I've had some wonderful results with elo combined with mezigdomide. We've also had great results with elo combined with iberdomide in CD38 DARA refractory patients. So I think these are exciting areas that we can explore. And again, what's so important is that they don't require hospitalization. They're outpatient therapies. These are real world community serving approaches that I think will get around the challenge that we face, because we have this real excitement around CAR-Ts. They're clearly, to use a well-used term, game changers. And we have the bispecifics, which are, again, changing the treatment paradigm. But, for my community-based patients, for my frailer, older patients, which are the majority of myeloma patients in reality, we need oral, simple, clinic-based approaches that give our providers and patients alike access in a way that some of these other strategies, exciting and promising as they are inherently more limited in their ability to so do.
So let's take it one step further and kind of start to get a little bit more into the clinical data that we have with the two main agents that you were talking about today. Kind of what I heard, and you can tell me whether it's, you can maybe refine it down a little bit. It kind of sounds like Mezi and Iberdomide were very similar and very tolerable therapies, for example, compared to IMiDs. The only difference I kind of saw was it looked like the efficacy, indirectly comparing, Mezi looked somewhat better than Iberdomide. But can you further differentiate clinically how you separate these two out?
Yeah, I think Iber is clearly less potent than Mezi, but I also want to stress that Iber is well tolerated. Mezi is more potent, and you have to work a little harder on the side effect profile, particularly the myelosuppression. I think, to my mind, Iberdomide is an ideal agent to be moving into the upfront space and to maintenance because of this favorable tolerability profile, especially the second cancer question. The mezigdomide platform, in my view, as someone who thinks, about relapsed refractory patients, and that's the majority of my practice, mezigdomide, to my mind, is a really important addition to the armamentarium for my relapsed refractory patients, and it's more powerful. But I think at the same time, the side effect profile that we see is very manageable, particularly when we think about, the difference, say, for example, with CAR T therapy or bispecific treatment may fail, what happens. So I think that in all respects, we need to have a strategic view of the disease. And I think Iberdomide, to my mind, is definitely the drug I would want to be thinking about earlier in disease, newly diagnosed, maintenance, first relapse. Mezigdomide would be my relapse refractory go-to. One thing I do want to stress, though, lenalidomide is an incredible drug. I mean, it's improved survival for myeloma patients across the globe. I mean, there is no doubt about that. But like all great approaches, there are some stings in the tail, as we all know. And the same thing can be said of POM. It's an amazing drug that's been transformative. Can we do better is the question. And I think cell mods potentially provide that possibility. I also think the degrader class and the CFT7455 molecule may be in that category too, although it's very early. I think we may be in a position to see oral agents, providing important bridges to next steps for an increasing number of our patients.
Looking at the available clinical data we have at this instant right now for these two agents, I'm curious if you could access either one or both of these agents right now. Are there situations where you would feel comfortable using the drugs right now?
Very much so. I mean, you know, we literally have a waiting list to get onto our mezigdomide study slots because that's how much in demand it is. I think the important point is, and that's in the relapse refractory setting, so you can understand why. I think in the relapse refractory space, that's where I would be very comfortable deploying these drugs. I think iberdomide, again, it doesn't have the potency of mezigdomide. I think, you know, Sagar and I have talked about this because he's leading the IBIS studies, I'm leading the MESI studies, and we work together. And there's a realization this is clear. These drugs are different in terms of their efficacy. But the difference is, IBA going up front is going to be just in a new league because it's that much cleaner, it's that much more potent. So I think IBA is going to be very exciting in early relapse and newly diagnosed and maintenance. And mezigdomide, to my mind, I would love to see it deployed sooner rather than later in relapse refractory disease because we really have an urgent need, Neil. We have an urgent need for an oral agent that is, or even just an outpatient infusional agent. I'm not going to be specific about mezi. It could be any in these classes. We need infusional agents that we can use in the clinic that are effective and available. What we, you know, this, you know, waiting list for the hospital, you know, you've got to come into the hospital for 2 weeks of dose escalation or, you know, for your actual CAR T. It's great if you can do it, but it's not so easy. And the logistics are real nowadays. And in the post-pandemic era, we're still coming out of that, as you know. So I think this need for oral truly outpatient strategies is real. And, as I think we've always felt in myeloma, it's kind of all hands to the pumps. It's never a case of one versus the other. You need all the agents that we can get our paws on.
So, yeah, I mean, I know that FDA approval has a lot of complexities to it. There are financial issues, et cetera. But you don't have to see too many cases like that second case you presented to want to use mezi in relapse disease when you run out of options, I mean, clinically. And but it also kind of brings up the question, are there patients right now you'd like to be using belantamab on, just out of curiosity?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And frankly, we'd be doing a lot of compassionate use melflufen because
really?
We need it. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Our real world experience with 12 patients of melflufen, 55% response rate, infusional therapy in the clinic, and no added toxicities. You know, that's what we're publishing that actually. No, I mean, I think this is the point is that I know it is so difficult because you've got these response rates of 30% and, you know, obviously the bispecifics are generating 60 to 70% and obviously the CAR T's are amazing. You know, cilta-cel is extraordinary, but it's, you know, multiple myeloma is just that you need all these options. And we particularly like belantamab because we find the ocular toxicity is manageable and it can be utilized in an outpatient setting where a bispecific and or a CAR T approach may not be feasible, particularly for a frailer patient who doesn't want to come into the hospital. In the same spirit, you know, we genuinely were really early adopters of melflufen, not least of which because we've done the studies and so we are very comfortable with the drug, but also in the compassionate use setting, we've continued with that to a lesser extent, of course, than belantamab because that has an expanded access program, which is that much easier to access. But I have to stress, I think all of these drugs matter. And I think that frankly, if I can pivot back to mezigdomide, you know, the availability of an oral agent that can be a backbone to drugs that patients have had before and get responses of 60, 70%. And obviously you have to be careful because if you get an accelerated approval for mezigdomide, it'll be to label, which will be mezi dex, fair enough. But in practice, you know this, Neil, you know, we'll take all we can to get our patient to the next step. And I think that's a very reasonable way to think about this.
Let me just clarify there. Are you saying you can start belantamab on a patient right now in terms of using compassionate use?
Expanded access. It's easier
but you can start somebody on it.
We can, but you have to have an expanded access program. Yeah. And we absolutely have to have that. And we also have clinical trials with belantamab. With melflufen, it's more complicated because unfortunately the clinical hold there meant that the clinical trial space stopped as well, but which hopefully will change for the better fairly soon. But the bottom line is that because, you know, it has full approval in Europe. I mean, that's the paradox. But we have compassionate use for melflufen. And I want to especially acknowledge Operation Facilitate. It's been fantastic in helping us access these drugs. But again, this is not for the community provider, unfortunately. This is for an academic center that has the resources to do it. But you can access these drugs. Yes, you can.
Another thing, as long as we're talking about FDA and all, you mentioned in your talk something called, I think it was called FDA Project Optimus.
Yes.
What is that?
I think this is basically that the FDA have adopted a series of major projects. Operation Facilitate is this idea of better access to drugs that are on the cusp of approval or not yet approved but under study. Project Optimus is basically designed to optimize drug delivery at dose schedule and development in phase one. And I think it's really, I so appreciate it. I mean, it's essentially designed to say, you know, get your doses and schedules right, because what you don't want to be doing is barreling into phase two and phase three and getting dose and schedule wrong. I think what we've realized in myeloma is you can have a lot of active regimens, but they can also be quite toxic too. And I think in that regard, you just have to be careful, because obviously, in the context of toxicity, I mean, efficacy is a function not just of activity, it's a function of toxicity. So you have to be careful of how you marry the two.
Interesting. I want to maybe take a step back and get some thoughts from you on the current management of myeloma, particularly in the upfront setting, and sort of how you see over the next few years the potential for CELMoDs sort of coming into the platform that currently exists. And maybe just to start out with, going back to the determination trial of any, we've talked about that ever since you presented it. Any new data that's come out, any new thoughts that you have about transplant?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think what's really clear there, and I want to be such a kind of you to give me the opportunity to revisit the whole concept of upfront therapy, Neil. I think upfront therapy becomes part of a strategic equation now. And I think the real game changer, of course, has been the arrival of the very powerful quadruplets. I think transplant clearly has a role, and it has a role for those patients in whom they're high risk and or have a significant burden of disease, despite, you know, a valiant attempt at quadruplet induction. The question really becomes, and this is what determination, I think, was so helpful in helping us understand as a guide to next steps, is that clearly one size does not fit all. In our standard risk MRD negative patients in determination, they're doing amazingly well, even with just triplet and then monotherapy maintenance. Conversely, the high risk group are a group we need to be careful about. But even in the high risk group, we've got subgroups who do much better than others. And this whole subgroup question has become really interesting. Now, we have presented data recently meetings. In fact, my colleague, Dr. Hani Soon, presented some really nice work at the EBMT meeting as an oral session, looking at the subgroups of determination. And what we're realizing is that particular subgroups don't seem to be very well served by transplant. This was a surprise to us. But patients, for example, of African-American heritage, and it's pathobiologic, it's not got to do with access to drugs or anything of that kind, there may be subgroups of patients in that category in whom transplant may be much less helpful than we thought. And it may be pathobiologic in its origin. And the story may lie in what's called Duffy null, which is a polymorphism that exists in up to 60 to 70% of African-American patients. So there's some fascinating pathobiology with dissecting. But I think in terms of where we're going, and I want to say that this year's upcoming ASH, my colleague, Dr. Jeff Sonder, who's leading our efforts in this regard, will be presenting, I hope, some really important data from determination, which will help guide us. You know, this concept that we can tailor therapy, and in particular, focusing on the African-American population. Because you may recall, Neil, in determination, we enrolled almost 20% African-American patients. So we were able to really take a look at this very important subgroup of patients and really help inform, I think, treatment choices. In any event, to your point, where does this lead us? Well, I think in the era of bispecifics in particular, and also CAR-T, the question of the role of high-dose melphalan continues to evolve. It has to. You've got wonderful platforms such as the teclistamab, such as L-now eratanab, you know, talquetamab. You've got this marvelous array of very powerful bispecifics. And of course, we've got the remarkable data of CARTITUDE-4, as well as the continued efficacy of ide-cel being seen, where you've got these new modalities changing the therapeutic landscape. So this is going to come earlier, right, Neil, isn't it? It obviously is. And that's going to change the need to embrace transplant in every patient. So I think we've clearly moved away from that. I think that as I look to the future, I'll be thinking that iberdomide would be a logical part of upfront therapy. As I look to the future, next generation antibodies could be an integral part. And that may not just be, bispecifics, but equally, for example, we're very interested in isatuximab. You know, isatuximab and daratumumab are obviously very similar, but there may be qualitative differences. And in that regard, we're looking at the opportunities offered by isatuximab up front. So there are lots of opportunities we're looking at to improve the efficacy of induction remission treatment.
Wow, so many questions. Any evidence or any thought that in any way isatuximab might be better than daratumumab in the upfront setting?
It's a great question, and obviously we don't know the answer. What we do know is if you look across trials with all the usual caveats, there are some intriguing signals. If you look at the ACAMA study, for example, versus CANDOR in the relapsed refractory space, you know, we see in the ACAMA study a median PFS of 42 months. For carfilzomib combined with isatuximab in relapsed refractory disease, 42 months. You know, it's a very important point because CANDOR did not generate that PFS. Now, I'm very careful because that's a classic cross-trial comparison. But nonetheless, it's striking. And with ICARIA, which we led, we saw the same type of phenomenon compared to APOLLO, where actually isatuximab combined with POM, some of the clinical signals in a slightly more heavily pretreated, sicker population were perhaps stronger. Again, nothing definitive, just sort of relatively subtle in the relapsed refractory space, although one could argue the ACAMA finding is not subtle. I would say to you that I think of them as very similar. I think daratumumab is a phenomenal antibody, and it's transformed survival for myeloma patients, no question about it. I just think that isatuximab is different, actually. And it binds with a different epitope. And I think in extramedullary disease, which is a particular interest of mine, I think there may be some differences in the way extramedullary disease emerges from CD38 targeting that may favor isatuximab. Now, this is really hypothesis at the moment, but we're working on this because it may mean that, you know, CD38 targeting, you've got choices. And I think where it does, from a patient point of view, is improves options, right, Neil? Because you can have had CD38 exposure up front with Dara, say, and then when you relapse, perhaps, you know, it's very reasonable to reach to isatuximab because they're not exactly the same. And especially if you've got extramedullary disease and using a CD38 in relapse makes sense. You're not quite ready for BCMA. So you can see how, Neil, these differences between the antibodies mean that there are opportunities to explore them in different ways.
So I'm heading towards maintenance. I'm trying to get there, but first a few other questions because I want to get your thoughts on where you think cell mods might fit in terms of maintenance. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about what you were saying about African Americans. Can you explain a little bit more about biologically the pathobiology you were just talking about?
Yeah, there's this intriguing concept that Duffy null polymorphisms may be associated with greater degrees of leukopenia, low white count, and this may have an adverse impact on outcomes for African American patients in cancer medicine because there's more myelosuppression, so therefore there's more dose interruption and less intensive chemotherapy administration. So unfortunately, that may impact adversely on anti-tumor effect. This is a broad concept. In breast cancer, this has been explored, and in fact, it's more complicated. The Duffy null isn't just a polymorphism that generates leukopenia, but there may be key inflammatory pathways, and that this inflammasome or this cytokine milieu within which disease exists may be different if you have this polymorphism. This is really important because in myeloma, as you know, the inflammasome is pretty much everything, right? It's a huge part of the pathobiology of the disease. And so what we observed in determination, which took us by surprise, was that the PFS gain that was so striking in determination for the population as a whole was not seen for the African-American population with identical therapy. And I am looking forward to everyone watching Dr. Jeff Zonder's presentation at ASH of our analysis, because what he's going to show is that, remarkably, medians for progression-free survival were quite different in these different populations. And this is very informative. And that's with identical treatment. So I think we have to be, so it's not socioeconomic, it is not access to therapy. There's something going on in the disease that's treating the impact of therapy or altering the way the impact of therapy affects outcome. The good news for African-American patients is that we're clearly showing that, you know, if there are reasons that you don't want to rush to a transplant, as long as other factors all being equal, say your standard risk, for example, and you've achieved a great response to induction therapy, our data would suggest, and this has already been published, so this is in no way stealing Jeff's thunder for ASH, because we've already published this, there is clearly from the hazard ratio for African-American patients, you could arguably keep transplant in reserve because you're not seeing that big benefit for African-American patients. And Jeff's work will show this really nicely in ASH and help us understand why. I also want to emphasize Joe McHale touched on this at the plenary session at ASCO last year. I mean, he spoke directly about this. And he used a real-world example, which was his patient who's African-American, who was an executive, and said, look, I've got too much on my plate. I need to keep my transplants in reserve. And he pointed to our hazard ratio and said, this, I would therefore tell him, it's okay, you can collect and store and wait, all other things being equal. What I'd hate our audience to take away from is, you know, if you've got a high-risk, poor prognosis African-American patient, just because they're African-American, you wouldn't take them to transplant. No. It's not what we're saying. We're just saying, think in a tailored fashion about your patient. You don't have to say one size fits all.
But when you think about, though, the African-American patients in determination, was there any evidence the treatment ended? Did they have more complications, more cytopenias, any sort of mechanistic explanation?
Brilliant question. That's again. Jeff is going to be presenting this, so I want to be
very careful.
That's
what I figured. That's what he's going to present. Wow.
I don't want to talk about that in the sense that it steals his thunder. What I can tell you, though, this is an important safety thing, is it wasn't a safety issue.
Really, the thing that really fascinating, you were mentioning breast cancer because, you know, the idea of leukopenia in African-American women, we've been hearing about for years in breast cancer. But you're saying we know the mechanism for that? You said Duffy something? We Duffy know the mechanism?
Duffy null is a polymorphism that occurs in about, it may not be as high as 70%. It may be more like 60% or 55 to 60%. In our study, it was a little higher. It was around 63%. My point is that Duffy null is a poor polymorphism that is engendered in African American patients because the mechanism, why would you have it? You may have it because actually it alters the way you respond to inflammatory responses from infections and other stressors. So a little bit like sickling has been favorable to resisting the malarial parasite, Duffy null may convey inflammatory responses that are favorable in the setting of multiple infections or something like that. I mean, I want to be careful because I have a bit of a hand waving going on here, but you see my point, Neil. It is a polymorphism that has had an evolutionary selection pressure that may be driven by infections and so forth and tropical diseases, etc. The point is that in neoplasia, in malignancy, and in particular in myeloma, we're trying to understand what this really means because determination may be showing us for the first time in the highest level of evidence, a randomized control phase 3 trial, that there's something going on here. And it's not just leukopenia. It's something more than that.
Is there any immunologic flavor to this?
Well, I think, let me walk you through my hypothesis. My hypothesis, and I want to be very clear to our audience, this is a hypothesis, which you'll hear more from Jeff about, but it's a hypothesis. It may well be that if you are Duffy null mutated, if you've got the polymorphism, that you actually are much more vulnerable to an inflammatory stressor. And in that context, disrupting this inflammatory, this cytokine milieu. So if you've got this cytokine, well, I guess this is a better term. There's a vulnerability to disruption of cytokine homeostasis. So that vulnerability to disruption of cytokine homeostasis may be actually something that high-dose melphalan with autologous stem cell rescue is actually quite challenging to. And that, in fact, when you disrupt that cytokine homeostasis in a particular patient who has an underlying polymorphism that leads to vulnerability in that space, you actually may impact on their ability not only to tolerate treatment, but this is the interesting thing, that the tolerance of treatment didn't actually seem to be the driver. For some reason, if you had that transplant, you know, the outcome was different than if you didn't. And I, again, I want to be very careful because Jeff's going to be speaking about this at ASH in a few months. And so I really want to make sure that that people know that that's where to hear this, because there'll be much more granularity in data. But my hypothesis is that there's something in this polymorphism that leads to a difference in biology. And this may explain in part why our African-American patients didn't see the same degree of PFS gain that our Caucasian counterparts did. The other thing that really feeds into this, which makes this inflammasome construct, I think, real, is body mass index. The body mass index was also an important factor. So the higher your BMI, the less benefit you got. That's a classic inflammasome effect, because you're much more inflamed if you're too heavy.
So do you get less benefit from transplant?
Possibly. I mean, that's, I mean, again, I want to be very careful because Jeff's going to be talking about this. I just want to share with you, Neil, that what I can say is what we published, which is the hazard ratio for African Americans just wasn't there in favor of it. So basically, that's the original observation. And now we've dug deep to better understand it. And it may lie in this Duffy null hypothesis, and it may also lie in this construct of the inflammasome.
Dr. McHale commented on in the plenary discussion, you know, it's really awesome that you were able to get so many African-American people in the study. But I'm thinking about, you know, most studies don't have that many African-Americans. So if they had that disparity, they would never know it. I mean, any reason to think other, like bispecifics, CAR T, other therapies, you might have a biologically different impact with African-Americans?
Yeah, it's a great question. Super. As always, Neil, your questions are phenomenal. I would just simply say, of course, it might. I would stress, though, I certainly don't want clinicians going away saying that I need to start treating people differently. I would just simply say that, you know, if you've got something as potentially challenging as a transplant, you know, with the attendant, you know, you've got to, you know, that, you know, the breadwinner in the family has to stop working for 3 months, you know, it's that you get my point. If there are other factors, then you might want to think about this. And I think it just pivots back to the point that, thinking about the complexity of each patient, thinking about a tailored approach. Because the beautiful thing is, Neil, in myeloma now, we've got multiple options. So to fight multiple myeloma, we have multiple options. We have 18 drugs outside of transplant and the traditional chemotherapeutics, 18. So, you know, to my mind, in 2023, for us to be thinking one size fits all, is clearly outmoded, in my opinion. I think we have to be thinking more strategically for our patients and saying, well, what's good for you? What's going to work for you? What's going to matter to your quality of life? What's going to matter to your family? And above all, you know, what does your pathobiology tell us? That this is the kind of way I think we have to start to think about the disease, rather than are you transplant eligible or not? And if you're transplant eligible, you get your high-dose melphalan. And if you're not, we'll look at other strategies. In the old days, that was very appropriate in the absence of other options. Now, of course, we've got lots of options, and therefore I think we need to think very imaginatively now, as we've been given the tools to so do.
So I'm really looking forward to Dr. Zonder's presentation. I have a feeling a lot of people are going to get a lot out of that. A couple other things I wanted to just get your take on, again, kind of see what where we are right now in general, where these agents are going to fit in. I'm going to ask you about maintenance, but before that, in what situations do you not add daratumumab up front, both older and younger patients nowadays, outside of a trial?
Basically, we use the antibodies up front now in our practice. Our group does that as a consensus. So we're using quadruplet therapy and just, you know, adjusting dose. And we will, of course, for an older, frailer patient, exploit what we've learned from Maya, you know, the use of DARA-RD, if we feel a proteasome inhibitor is too challenging. I must be honest, because we really know how to use proteasome inhibitors and then are able to manage tolerability, you know, our by far the most popular regimen is RVD light plus DARA. You know, we just use that, and it's exquisitely active and well tolerated. And for the younger, higher risk patient, we'll think carfilzomib. But I also like to keep carfilzomib for second line, because I think you have to think strategically. You know, if bortezomib fails the patient over time, you've got to have your next big gun ready to go. But obviously not every patient can tolerate carfilzomib. So, you know, and we're also big users of exazomib as a result of that. So as a result of a sort of strategic view, we think quads up front, and we're very comfortable tailoring it for the older, frailer patient.
And in terms of maintenance, there are a number of issues that people have questions about. One is when you bring in a proteasome inhibitor. The other is when do you bring in daratumumab in the maintenance setting? How are you, again, outside of a trial setting, tailoring your maintenance therapy to patients?
Yes, super question. Well, lenalidomide is the backbone. We were very comfortable integrating proteasome inhibition. Typically, we'll use bortezomib every couple of weeks. We'll use exazomib in the appropriate patient who's higher risk with, say, you know, a 17p deletion. And we've become early adopters of daratumumab as part of maintenance. Yeah. And essentially, we use daratumumab monthly with len, and then we'll add a PI if we feel they're higher risk and have more concern. Say, for example, they're 17p deleted.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is a number of times you comment on the issue of extramedullary disease, and I hear more and more myeloma investigators pointing that out to me in trials the way you are doing it today. And I just wonder whether or not that is being thought about in terms of trial design and also clinically, where you see the most common. I was kind of surprised to see that big liver lesion there. What are the common sites of extramedullary disease and their prognosis?
Great question, Neil. Extramedullary disease, gastrointestinal, extramedullary in the sense of reticular endothelial, so liver, spleen, nodal, pulmonary. I think as patients live longer with myeloma, we're seeing more and more extramedullary disease. It's a very negative prognostic finding in the advanced disease setting. CNS disease we're now seeing, which we didn't see very much of before. Not that that's common, but it's more frequent than it used to be. I think
CNS in the brain?
Yeah, parenchymal disease. Yeah, not common. Wow. I mean, I don't want folks to be thinking, you know, it's everywhere. It isn't. Extramedullary disease is much more everywhere, and that's why you're hearing so much more about it, Neil. I think extramedullary disease has become a new focus, and that's why I'm particularly excited about mezigdomide, because I think it's clearly showing a signal that it can work in extramedullary disease. But honestly, that's why, you know, we were particularly excited and remain so about melflufen. Melflufen is an outstanding drug in EMD. That's what we showed in the Horizon study. In the OCEAN trial, the signal for EMD was a little more mixed, but that was such a different setting, much earlier relapse, and you were dealing with a post-transplant population. It was a very, very different setting. Horizon was a classic relapse refractory, four or more prior lines, triple class, and the EMD there was responsive. I would only say to you that we obviously need to do better than melflufen, that's for sure. But the fact of the matter is we can now, especially if we combine and look at these strategies. And I think that the fact of the matter is, too, that some of our BCMA targeting strategies do appear to work for extramedullary disease, but not consistently. And belantamab mafodotin, for example, hopefully will come off the hold list fairly soon with randomized trials coming in. But that's not terribly effective in EMD, in my experience. So I'm very much hoping we'll be given all the tools in the toolbox to fight EMD. And I think mezigdomide is one good example of that. I do actually think combination strategies with melflufen make great sense in this setting. And hopefully, as I say, we'll be able to get those back into the research space sooner rather than later. And I think that at the same time, other strategies for EMD will include things like, for example, you know, perhaps, you know, for a person who's more vulnerable to EMD, if we can figure out who that may be, you might use isatuximab as their upfront CD38. But conversely, you know, daratumumab, which may be a little bit more vulnerable to extramedullary escape, could be, you know, accordingly tailored. I mean, again, these are all open questions, but I fully agree with your colleagues who've called in saying, you know, EMD is a problem for us. I would 100% agree with them that it is an increasing challenge.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Richardson, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.